the Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. On today's episode, we have a special surprise, a special treat. Recently, the Arthropod gang was invited by the Entomological Society of America to be a part of an early career professional webinar series. We gave a seminar called Three Hosts in an Arthropod. We were very honored to be invited. Our host was Dr. Karen Poe of Penn State University, and I'm going to go ahead and let her take everything away for the rest of the episode.
Well, welcome everyone to our webinar today. So today's webinar is Three Hosts in an Arthropod podcast, how three entomologists communicate their love of insects. And we are so glad that everyone can join us today. I think we are at about 60 participants today, so that's super exciting. Literally thought it would just be probably the four of us talking, which would still be just as fun. But we're so glad that everyone can join us here today. So my name is Karen Poe, and I'm a postdoc in the Department of Entomology at Penn State University. And I also serve as the ECP representative for the MOVE section. Now, as a member of the ECP committee, I help coordinate webinars that can benefit not only ECPs, but really the general membership of ESA. And we're always looking for people to host different webinars. So if you have a future webinar topic that you want us to pursue or that you would like to host yourself, feel free to contact me. You can contact me via my email or DM me on Twitter, or you can DM the ECP committee on Twitter as well. And I'll put those contacts in the chat in a couple of minutes. Now, before we get started today, I do want to remind everyone that this is a Zoom webinar format. So I think we're all pretty familiar with Zoom meetings and Zoom webinars. So with the webinar, don't be alarmed if you don't see or hear yourself. That's completely normal. But we still want you to encourage, or we still want to encourage everyone to interact with the guests today. So feel free to leave any comments in the chat or any questions in the Q&A, and we'll answer any of your questions live as soon as we can. Now, this is a completely informal conversation with our speakers as well. So feel free to add questions as you think of them. I would also like to mention that this webinar is recorded, and you can view a recording of this webinar on the ESA website, like Cindy mentioned, in the webinar archives. And this webinar audio will also be posted on the Arthropod show. So stay tuned for a link to that episode once it's been posted. Now, we are so excited to have everyone here today. So let's get started with some introductions from our guest speakers. So today I have three fabulous entomologists joining me today for this webinar, and they are the hosts of the Arthropod Show, which is a really fun podcast dedicated to spreading the word and the love for the fun and wacky world of insects and beyond. So as entomologists here in this group, I think we all know that insects and really arthropods in general are really fun and wacky. So today we have Drs. Jody Green, Jonathan Larson, and Michael Scavarla here today. And I'll now turn it over to our guests to kind of give us a rundown of their title and position, your affiliation, as well as just a brief overview of your research and the outreach that you kind of do and how you actually got into entomology. So kind of your little origin story in terms of going into entomology. So Dr. Jody Green, did you want to go first?
Oh, okay. So my name's Jody Green. My pronouns, she, her. I'm currently an extension educator with Nebraska Extension, so employed by UNL, and I'm in a county office, so I'm not on campus. I really don't see a lot of other entomologists at all, so this is actually pretty fun, and I deal a lot with the public and anybody who calls, comes in, emails, tweets, so I talk to everyone. I have a master's and PhD in entomology from Purdue University. Let's see. It's a way too long story for origin because I feel like I'm a late bloomer, and it took me a really long time to get into entomology. I never knew that it would ever be a career for me, but I've always loved bugs. And I mean, my background is pest management. So a lot of it is I'm an experienced licensed killer sometimes, but I don't want to. So I will always choose to exclude and prevent and modify environment. So if anybody wants those kind of things, they come to me. I'm not really sure how I even got into what I'm doing, but I love it and it's so much fun. So I'll leave it with that. But I do talk to everybody, master gardeners, youth, pest management professionals. I'm on everybody's side, pretty much just promoting education and science. So
awesome. I was also a very late bloomer in entomology as well, to be honest. So, Michael, did you want to go next?
Sure. Let me unmute myself. My name is Michael Scavarla. I am an assistant research professor at Penn State University, and I run the insect identification lab here. So similar to Jody, I'm getting all kinds of insect requests and other arthropod requests. People want to know what they are, if they're pests, and if they're pests, how to control them. Unlike Jody, a lot of what I get has been filtered through our county extension system already. So I'm at Penn State usually getting on main campus, usually getting like the weird stuff that can't be identified at the county level. So like I get a really common pest in our area are Japanese beetles, and I get basically zero of them every year because they're really easy to identify. And so they get turned around at the county. And it's just the weird stuff that is coming up to me that they don't know what it is. Let's see, what else was there? How I got into entomology. Unlike Jody, I was interested at a really young age. My dad took me out. I had to build a collection for Boy Scouts, and it was February. And he said, let's make an insect collection. And I said, you know, because I was a smarmy 8-year-old, how are we going to do that? There's snow on the ground. So we trudged out to a fallen log and pulled the bark back and found a bunch of hibernating insects that I made my collection with. And from that point, I decided I wanted to work with insects in some way. It was pre-internet, so I didn't know you could be an entomologist. I just knew that that's what I like, bugs, that's it, right? So I went to undergrad at Purdue for an entomology undergrad, and kind of found my way through what all entomology has to offer, and became a taxonomist and systematist before I ended up at Penn State. I think that's everything.
Yeah. Didn't you also grow up in Pennsylvania? So wouldn't February be very cold?
It was. I grew up about 2 hours away from Penn State. So this is nice. It's close enough. I can see my family every now and again. And yeah, there was literal snow on the ground that we had to brush away from the log, probably 2 or 3 inches that day. So it was a real like light bulb moment, like, oh shoot, this is what I want to do.
Yeah. We love a good origin story, but that sounds like a very cool one. So, but we're glad that you're here today as an entomologist. And last but not least, Jonathan, did you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'll be the middle ground. Since Jody says she's a late bloomer, Mike says he's an early bloomer. I was a mid-ground bloomer. I am an assistant professor of extension entomology at the University of Kentucky. I am sort of the super agent. I guess I'm the agent to the agents for a lot of things like Mike was discussing, getting some diagnostic sort of requests and building a lot of materials for them to be able to hand out and to put on their Facebook pages and things like that. In terms of the things that I'm supposed to deal with, I have been assigned urban landscapes, turf grasses, nursery crops, high tunnels, greenhouses, households, veterinary pests, and some human health pests. So if it bites plants and people in the city or suburbs, I kind of end up with some of those questions. I have a pretty wide purview, luckily. I got into entomology through 4-H. I was a 10-year 4-H-er in the state of Indiana, and I was the only entrant in my county fair 1 year, and I got selected to go to the state fair by default, which I was, you know, sort of proud of as a 13 or 14 year old. And in Indiana, it used to be if you got invited to the state fair in entomology, you got invited to a day in the department at Purdue University. And I went there and I got to hang out with all kinds of cool entomologists, including Dr. Jody Green. She was a graduate student, and she showed us around in her lab and showed us there were like buckets with cockroaches in them. I think she remembers this room of cockroaches. And she was showing us these termites that she had fed different colors. So they were different colors, and her research with them. And I was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. This is the coolest person I've ever heard talk about science. This is what I'm going to do. I also met like Tom Turpin and stuff that day. I was just absolutely floored with all of the things you could do to talk to people about bugs. And I decided that was what I wanted to do. And that's how I ended up here.
Man, I love hearing origin stories about people. That's awesome. So we have someone who's a late bloomer, a mid bloomer, and an early bloomer in entomology. So thank you for your introductions, everyone. I'll add everyone's contact information to the chat in case anyone from the audience wants to reach out to any of our speakers today. But now let's move into a little bit about science communication, just a little bit more broadly. So I looked up the modern definition of science communication. By modern, I really just mean it was from Wikipedia. So that's as modern as it can get. And so the modern definition of science communication is the practice of informing, educating, raising awareness of science-related topics, and increasing this sense of wonder about scientific discoveries and arguments. And so hearing this definition, do you think that there's anything else that might be missing from this definition? And how would you change it? And in other words, what does science communication really mean to you guys?
So I wrote down a few things. And, you know, like when you do like any kind of mission statement, you just move around the words or, you know, you think of word clouds because you can't even like it. We use that word, that term all the time, but it's so hard to define. And so I wrote like three lines, okay? Effectively sharing research-based information that has like meaning and truth. And I guess that depends on who the person is, right? And then being able to inclusively engage with others in your area expertise. I guess that's from maybe the expert's perspective. And then I wrote, getting your grandma pumped about something cool that you know. And that was from a conversation I had with my husband once that, you know, he has a PhD in food science. And his grandma, when she was alive, asked, like, well, what do you study? And he was like, well, you know, DNA and lobster, you know? And so I was like, grandma, this is what he does. And, you know, and then I went and helped her understand what he did and why it was important. And why he loves it. So, men.
It's the same problem with virtual things. It's really hard to tell, like when you're going to jump in and not step on over somebody speaking. I think for me, science communication really relates to the extension mission that we're part of. So I've got a 100% extension appointment, which means that I am taking science-based information from like primary sources in scientific literature and translating that into a way that the general public can understand and use that information to solve their problems. Because I'm doing insect IDs, that's always related somehow to the insects that they're encountering. But for me, science communication is part of this continuum of getting information to the public. So with extension, we're getting targeted information to interested stakeholders that need that information for a solution. While science communication kind of goes along that, you're not getting information necessarily for a solution, but you're still getting people science-based information about something that they're interested in, getting them excited about the topic. And so I guess I see it linked, but slightly different from like the normal day-to-day, kind of extension work that I do.
That's interesting. I also see it as part of the extension mission. I see it also almost extension writ large, like the recognition that extension has kind of become very specialized as we've gone over the last 100 and some odd years. And it's become very associated with agriculture in particular. And I think science communication is something that we can see as an evolution of extension. It will help us to knock down that wall a little bit and to recognize that extension's mission from the beginning was to recognize learning didn't stop when people left campus. Like we have the three-part mission in a land-grant college of teaching, research, and extension. And teaching is when they're on campus, research is discovering new things, and extension was supposed to take what we were learning and take it to all of our communities that we had an individual office in. And I think that it got kind of squished more and more as we went on into helping specific groups of people, like Mike said, talking to farmers, talking to practitioners, and that science communication can help us to knock down some of those barriers and get back to talking to everybody. So it's extension with sort of a wide open engine on it, I think.
Yeah, those are really great definitions. I also think science communication is kind of not only communicating the information, but also communicating your passion. I think you guys kind of were alluding to that as well. If you're not passionate about what you're talking about, then probably your audience won't be as well, I've come to realize. And so I think it's also really important to be able to communicate that really, that big enthusiasm that we have for the subject that you're communicating about. So those are really great definitions, or at least an expansion of that modern definition, the Wikipedia definition of science communication. Now, similar to what I asked about your origin stories for entomology, how did you guys first get into science communication? Like, what was that gateway activity that kind of led you down this path of science communication? Was it something you pursued actively, or is it something that you kind of just fell into and you're like, I like it here. This is awesome.
I would say I actively pursued it. So I when I went to Purdue, before I went there, I was in high school still. And I actually volunteered to be a part of Bug Bowl for 2 years while I was in high school, because I saw that as just this like huge science. We didn't have the phrase science communication yet. But when I was growing up, I kind of wanted to be some sort of like Mr. Rogers, Bill Nye, science guy kind of person, teacher. And I saw all of these opportunities being done at Purdue. And that was what really hooked me, was just seeing where you could be like, look at all these weird things. And there were 30,000 people that would wander through the doors to touch hornworms and learn about scarab beetles and put on VR goggles and pretend to be a bee. That definitely pulled me into the orbit of all this, and learning about outreach and then extension, and then getting more into science communication as ESA has expanded sort of its focus on it and presenting it as a possible career option for people. I've been really proud of what ESA has done the last few years. What about you two weirdos?
Jody, you go.
Okay. I guess I didn't really for a really long time think that what I was doing was science communication. But I started, I taught a summer, I was a camp counselor at a summer science camp for very privileged children. So I was basically a babysitter trying to teach them science, and they didn't care. But it was like kids aged like 5 to 13. And I'm sure it just sounds crazy because I'm really not even a kid person, but I would get to throw dodgeballs at them for breaks. But I mean, I was with them all day long, and it was from high school. I was in high school to my first couple of years in college. So it's probably why I didn't want to have children for a long time too, because for 7 years I was trying to teach kids science, and it was the fun stuff that wasn't, you know, necessarily in school. A lot of the stuff they do here in 4-H, like rockets and just really cool science stuff, I think. But so I think that's how I started off, just knowing how to talk to different audiences. And so even though I don't do a lot of youth education here, maybe I do, but I feel like I'm not a youth educator because I'm so used to talking to adults now. But that was my gateway. And then also, when I was in grad school, my advisor he had a very heavy extension appointment. So whenever he was asked to do a talk, he would be like, "Do you just want to do it?" So I got thrown out to do these really cool things. And at the time, like, I didn't know if he really liked me or if he hated me, but it taught me a lot. And it, you know, I mean, when you're an extension, or if you're out talking or doing some program, anything can happen, right? It's, you're interacting with people. So comments could happen. Technology can fail. Everything can fail, basically. And you just kind of go with it. So, that was pretty much my pathway. I feel like I've always been in it now. And just like with Jonathan, Purdue, entomology is great for having any kind of outreach. Like if you want to go out and teach at preschool, I did that. And I never did that again, right? Like you get opportunities that you find out what you like, and it's really important to find out what you don't necessarily like either. So
I had no interest in doing science communication whatsoever.
I'm glad you're being honest about it.
In fact, I actively avoided it. So in grad school, once I figured out that I wanted to do like taxonomy and systematics, and I got into grad school, I was there to do my research project. We had a grad student association, and they did outreach on occasion. And there was an expectation that we as grad students would two times per person over the summer run like an outreach booth at the local farmers market. But beyond that, any outreach or extension you did was optional. And to me, I was here to do my project. I was here to do research, and I didn't do any of it because it was not worth my time. And then I got this job at Penn State that was 100% extension. And my job here is identify insects. Like, okay, I've got that bit. Talk to the public. I have zero experience doing that because I've actively avoided it for the last 10 years. But I had the same mentality I did in grad school where I'm going to throw myself 110% at the thing that I'm supposed to be doing. So even though I'd avoided it in the past, like it's my job now, I'm going to be good at it. And so kind of dove in and really embraced the extension that I'm supposed to be doing and found that when it's part of my job description and I should be doing it, I actually really enjoy it. I found that I like working with the public and interacting with them and helping them solve their problems. And as an extension of that, really enjoy kind of getting science out to people that are interested in hearing about it.
I'm just laughing at the fact that you said you didn't like science communication or that you didn't like speaking publicly. But I have to say, you're very good at it, Michael, for someone who doesn't like it.
Oh, no, I like it now. It was just at the time in grad school, like, that's not why I'm here.
It's even before that. Mike and I were undergrad roommates at Purdue, and we used to argue about this because I was like, this is cool, we should go do it. And he was like, that's dumb, I don't know why you're going to go. Like, we used to have actual discussions about this.
It's true.
Yeah. So we actually have a couple of questions come in through the Q&A and the chat. So I'm just going to be switching around for a couple of minutes. So someone asked in the Q&A, would it be an odd thing to speak about entomology at, say, like an open mic?
I don't think so at all. I think that'd be cool. Awesome. Yeah, that'd be a great idea. I mean, if it's an open mic comedy night or something or jam poetry, like you might have to think about the format and how you're going to present what you want to talk about with these things. But if it's just an open microphone and they're like, hey, come tell us what you're an expert at, like The Moth, isn't that a podcast where people come and tell stories and things? I think that would be absolutely amazing. That's one of the things people ask us a lot is, how do I do this? How do I talk to people about bugs? Just look for where people are listening. And if there's an open microphone, there's presumably an audience of people in front of it, thirsty to hear something weird.
Turn it into Science Cafe or Bugs and Bourbon.
Yep. We actually have two grad students at the UK Entomology Department that tonight they're going to go out to a farm that's owned by a local brewery. We got them set up with this Thirsty Thursday science pub night. And they're going to talk about, one of them is going to talk about her tick research and one of them is going to talk about her brown marmorated stink bug research. I think they've got 50 or 60 people signed up to show up. So if there's opportunities, take them when you find them.
Ooh, is it called Stinking and Drinking?
I wish that had happened, but it
should have been.
No, yeah.
It should have been. That's awesome. So Krista Kerrigan, I hope I said that right. I apologize if I butcher any names today. They asked, what are some formats you think are working really well for science communication to adults? Social media, podcasts, videos, in-person events, or newsletter articles?
All the above.
I agree. <Yeah. laughs> I think it really just depends on the audience that you ask as well. And probably their age bracket.
We believe in podcasts as a group. I mean, we put one out twice a month, so we hope that that's working and we think the evidence bears that out. But I also think that, it depends on what you want to communicate and it depends on what group you're talking to. What do you think, Mike?
I was going to say, I think it depends on figuring out who your audience is and in figuring out what methods they are using to communicate and meet them there. Like, you're not going to get, like, my grandma's not going to listen to a podcast. She's probably not even going to go to a live person event or something, or even use the internet because she doesn't have a computer. So like all of those methods are out, but she'll talk to you on the phone, or, you know, read a flyer if it shows up in her mailbox. So, I think all of those formats that were mentioned are valid. It's just a matter of figuring out what audience those formats are reaching and how to tailor your message to that audience in a way that they will be receptive to it.
apparently it's a novel idea also to ask them, like, if there is a distinct group of people. I have found in extension sometimes people are like, oh yeah, I guess we could ask them what they want, like how they want to hear these messages. So sending a survey to them, directly asking them what they want, or seeing where they're talking already. There's a Southeast hemp research and extension group that noticed all of the hemp farmers were on Facebook talking all the time. And so they made a Facebook group for them to come and have a centralized discussion, and they can disperse research-based information from. So figuring out where your market's at and how you're going to infiltrate it is also a tactic.
Agreed. I know here at Penn State, we released a vector-borne disease survey, and there were very distinct age brackets that preferred certain ways of receiving their information. Some people like social media, some people like things to hold, like papers or brochures, some like looking online. So it really helps drive like a lot of your decisions in determining what kind of different types of outreach that you want to do for in terms of science communication.
Be prepared to do it all.
Yeah, pretty much. Yes, Michael.
One last thought going along with that is recognizing which of those methods you enjoy. I don't particularly like most forms of social media. I deleted my Facebook. So for me, that I found that Facebook stressed me out more than I got out of it. And so that for me is not a method I'm going to use regardless of what the audience is. If there's an audience that I need to reach that way, then I'll rely on colleagues or some other way to try to reach them, because I just personally can't do it. So part of it is recognizing, yeah, what methods that you're comfortable using or you enjoy using. The three of us have really found that we enjoy podcasting. And so that's kind of, you know, we landed on that. Other people I've talked to that have come and asked, like, okay, how do you make a podcast? I want to do that. They start into it and they make it an episode or two done, and then find that they don't really enjoy it that much and drop it. And that's okay. That's not for them. And it shouldn't be for everybody. But you do have to recognize like what you enjoy doing, and that has an impact on how you're going to communicate with people.
Yeah. And I think some people sometimes forget that, you know, as a science communicator, you also have a choice in determining what works for you as well, not just for your audience. So I do have another question. One is from Audrey Sheridan, and they asked all three of you, do you feel like your duty as a science communicator is not only to bridge research and practice, but to relay the needs of the public back to the research community?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, that's part and parcel of the extension mission, hopefully.
It can be difficult to do that sometimes. Especially because of like how funding often works. But like all of the research that I do at Penn State is driven by, honestly, a lot of the specimens that I get in the ID lab. The big project that me and Karen are actually working on right now is focused on deer keds. And that was wholly generated because I was getting deer keds in the lab that were biting people and they wanted to know what they were. And from that, I recognized like there's very little research on this. So yeah, certainly it should definitely go the other direction. It just can be an issue sometimes getting funding to do that or spinning it in such a way that people want to give you money, to do it.
Money is important, unfortunately.
Yeah. There's a foundation with the National Pest Management Association that does, you know, urban research, or they want to know. So it's always good to go to their meetings and anywhere that's, you can meet with other entomologists in your field of study, which, you know, I don't do any research. It's all extension, but I'm talking to the public all the time. And basically, I think there's two of us in Nebraska. So even though I'm in a certain county with most of the people, if they want to know what's seasonal, how many calls I get, I record all those things. And so if they're looking for data, then I have that, you know. I mean, we have a lot of things for people to complain about, but they don't realize, like, we're in Nebraska. We actually don't have as many bugs as other places. But if someone were to ask, like, what, you know, if we could do research, what could we do? I mean, I would love a carpenter bee artificial home, so, you know, people didn't have to try to kill them all.
Okay. So going back to our original question about science communication in general, what are some things that you wish you knew about science communication when you first started getting more involved in this field?
Yeah, I think maybe it was a little bit different for me because I was older or had a late bloomer. I was going to say not older, but I had like several random degrees or diplomas from different places, had worked with children. I have a bachelor's degree in gerontology. So I've worked with seniors and I love old people. And my career now, my master gardener relationships and like everything's kind of come together, my gerontology and entomology with the master gardeners. And I love teaching and working with master gardeners. But I would have really liked to have done more training with like soft skills, understanding differences, diversity, those things that are important now, things about, you know, what triggers people may have, because insects are very polarizing to people, right? And so you can't just come at them like, this bug is so cool. All the time, because, you know, something might have happened to them. So just being able to understand people more. And I say all the time that people, like the bugs are the easy part, the people are the difficult part. And so having to deal with people are things that we're not trained with in entomology sometimes, you know, maybe it's a little bit different now, but back in the day, we didn't really, we did our research and study different things, but you had to do that on your own if you wanted to do outreach and learn about people, I guess. So the social sciences and definitely those things would have been more helpful to be better in science communication.
I think some universities and some departments of entomology are dedicating classes to outreach now as well. I think Penn State might have had, a seminar class on science communication, how to do outreach. I think University of Georgia also has a class as well. So I think we're making those strides to help better prepare our future generations of entomologists with outreach. So we're getting there. Michael or Jonathan?
Oh, until Jody had said all that, I didn't have anything that I had thought of. But I wholeheartedly agree. Like, knowing how to interact with people and how to meet them so that they can, digest the information that you're trying to get to them. I got no training on. It's been especially difficult learning how to deal with people that I suspect have delusory parasitosis or Ekbom syndrome. There's a question in the questions that Karen sent us about the most difficult part of it. So maybe I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but dealing with those folks who, have a legitimate problem and have been often kicked around between various physicians and other people that don't believe them or aren't helping them. And as entomologists, we're often their last stop and, you know, they can be pretty frazzled by the time they get to us. Learning how to deal with them in a way that can help them has probably been one of the most challenging things that I've had to learn. And unfortunately, even amongst entomologists, you bring it up and people will be dismissive or mean about it. So even amongst like entomologists, it's difficult often to figure out how to talk to these people. And it's only been through networking with like John and Jody and other insect identifiers like Matt Bertone down at NC State who are also doing this that I've figured out like tips and tricks on trying to communicate with them.
Yeah. And that language matters, like how, or, you know, the tone and body, like just reading people. I think it's so difficult when it comes to like, those are things we were never, ever trained about. It's something you just experience and you probably don't feel good at all the first like 50 times.
Yeah. Since you have to do it by trial sort of. Yeah. It can be uncomfortable. What I wish I had classes on when I was a grad student would have included making presentations and writing for a general audience. I would have also really loved to have a survey class or like how to get extension data type class, how to find out what you want to find out from the public. These things are not necessarily emphasized, but then you're thrown into these career paths and you're told like, you need to figure out how you've changed people's behavior over decades in some cases. And it's like, I don't even know where to start with something like that. So there's some learning on the fly when you get going in an extension career path, and it's hard to, you have to buy books. And I was trying to find my survey book that I bought, but I think I left it at home. These things are all tough, and customer service, that would have also been cool. Just like a class on how to handle difficult people and maintain your dignity, how to build boundaries and make sure that people understand that you are also a person. You are not their bug Google that they can throw samples at and questions at and just expect output to come from you. And, but how to make sure they still feel like they got a satisfactory answer. Those are some things that I think would have been very helpful at the start of an extension career.
Agreed.
Agreed as well. I actually had someone mention to me after a talk I gave about ticks, like, do you know why we didn't have ticks back in the days? Because we sprayed DDT everywhere. And I just went, interesting.
Interesting.
Very unique answer. but anyway, yeah, those are really good things to keep in mind, especially as people who may be a little bit newer here in our audience, who may be new to science communication. Those are really good things to keep in mind as we go through this journey of science communication together. So what are some ways that people can get more involved in science communication?
I'd just say start doing it. But, you know, pick one way that you're going to start, either, you know, a podcast or a blog or whatever you're going to do, but also stick with it. You know, see a lot of these projects where people have really great ambition at the beginning and then find out that it's actually a lot of work and you have to be consistent about it. And after a couple of weeks or maybe even a couple of months, it falls off and they stop. So, you know, start small, make your goals. Like, I'm going to make one podcast episode this month. I'm going to write two blog posts this month. I'm going to, you know, make it manageable so that you can complete those tasks. You get that shot of serotonin in your brain for getting something done, and get the reward, and, you know, set yourself up for success early on and then build off of that, instead of, you know, it's similar to writing. Like, you're not going to probably write your grand novel as your first writing thing. Write a short story first or a 10-page essay or something. Start small and make sure you can hit your goals and, you know, build up from there.
I also like to encourage people to think about the spaces they like to be in and the places that they like to learn information from. So I know Mike said he deleted his Facebook page. He doesn't like Facebook. If you don't have a Facebook, maybe that's not for you, but maybe you love TikTok videos. Look around and see what you can do in terms of making. We just started an extension TikTok program in my lab with an intern this summer. And it's going gangbusters. It's really awesome to watch. She loves making the videos. She is not an entomologist, but she's learning kind of on the job about bugs. But she's helping us to understand how to utilize that app and that technology. Make streams. Do whatever it is that you like to be in, like places that you can see as an information avenue that you know and you enjoy the experience of. There are ways to connect with those places. You know, connect in Reddit if that's your place. You can post about bugs and things there. Don't just think about it as the very think about the new avenues. There's always new ways to talk to people that are out there. There's always fact sheets and things when you get a solid career, but try to think of the weird, innovative ways too that you can connect with people.
And it depends like where you are too. If, I mean, I see that we may have some younger audiences here today. So, I mean, there are outreach departments if you're already at a university, and even if you're not there and you're a younger aspiring entomologist, reach out to someone in entomology department. I think we're very passionate about what we do. We love sharing it and we love to know that there are others that want to maybe do something that we're doing. There are a lot of special events that go on. We've got a lot of, you know, it's National Moth Week. So get active if you like moths. If, you know, there's National Pollinator Week, there's a national something every week, right? And there's city nature challenges. If you like botanical gardens, there's talks there. There are a lot of ways you can meet experts or people that are also passionate about the same things. But then there are also ways that you can get in there and talk about what you want to talk about as well. You know, scouts, Skype a scientist, alumni associations will have different places you can talk. If I think about all the places that I have to say no to, because I just don't have the time, you know, there's a long list. And so even if you aren't in extension, but you want, you know, you have something you want to share, there are places that if you want to share it, there will people that want to listen to it. So, you know, see you, meet you, all that stuff.
Awesome. It's just like the classic Shia LaBeouf, like, just do it. Just do it.
Just do it.
Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about y'all's podcast now. So you guys host the Arthropod Show, the podcast. It's really fun. Love it. How did the three of you actually start this podcast together? What was kind of the catalyst that got all three of you together to be like, hey, let's do a podcast together?
Jonathan Larson.
Do you want me to cover that?
My answer is Jonathan Larson.
I started podcasting with Arthropod in 2014. I was doing it on my own at first because I wanted to make something weird and new in extension. And I wanted to show that this was a viable avenue in my new job. I actually worked in Nebraska for 5 years. And I wanted to be like, look, you can, there are other ways to talk to people. Like this is weird. We can be in their pocket, in their ears, whenever they want. It's going to be amazing. And so I started it and I quickly realized it was very difficult to do a podcast on your own and have like a monologue that you delivered. I don't know how some of the podcasters that are famous do it, where they just talk to themselves for an hour straight, basically. And I started doing interviews after that. I was running out of people who were willing to be interviewed. And I almost quit doing it. And then I said, you know what? I want to do this with my two really good friends. And I think that they will be good podcasters. They have different kinds of energy than I have. They have different kinds of energy than each other. And I think that as a triumvirate, as a trio, that we have a lot to offer and that people will want to hear what we have to say just by being weird, passionate bug people. So I asked them each politely if they would do it. And I guess I tricked them. I don't really know why they said yes.
Love how you said you tricked them, but I'm sure they enjoy it. they probably wouldn't have done it if they didn't want to.
Yeah. No, I do it because I love these guys. I get really excited when it's like recording day and we get so distracted, or I do anyway.
I do have to program in like an hour and a half for a recording session because I always know there's going to be 30 minutes of pure nonsense.
Shenanigans.
That's a better way of putting it, actually.
Okay. So you said that you started this podcast in like 2014. So it's 2021. That's 7 years of hosting the Arthropod Show. So what has kind of been everyone's favorite experience thus far with the podcast? Do you have like a favorite episode or a topic, interviews, just general experiences?
I think my favorite so far was when the book Bug Girl came out and we got to interview Sophia, who helped write it. And it was her story and her experience that led to the book. I've enjoyed a lot of the interviews that we've done with researchers and people that are like on our level and giving that information out to the public. But she was so sweet and it was really rewarding to be able to talk to her and further share her story. And I really enjoyed that. Mm-hmm.
That was a special episode. What do you think, Jody?
I can't even remember a whole lot of them, but I liked one of the recent ones that about the periodical cicada quiz bowl, because first of all, it's still in my memory. And because then I didn't have as much FOMO that I wasn't there, you know, during brood 10.
You were missing out on it.
Yeah. I was really missing out, but, yeah, I like a lot of them.
They're all a lot of fun. Yeah. We're learning a lot about Napoleon lately. I think my favorite just whole thing is like that when Jody and Mike came on board, it was like starting anew again. And there was a lot of energy and we've grown together as a trio of podcasters. Like, there were times where it was awkward and we didn't know when to speak and how to speak, because it used to be Jody and I in person and Mike digital. Now we're all online from three different places, two different time zones. And I've just enjoyed feeling us get better at it and growing, I guess. Make Dr. Larson explain the crack about Napoleon. So as part of our show growth, we have been wanting to do more sort of scripted episodes where one of us comes in as an expert and presents a topic that they are very passionate about. I did a pair of episodes on the history of the rise and fall of DDT. Jody went out and got a good interview with Dr. Harlan of the Harlan bedbug strain. And Mike said that he wanted to talk about the history of insects versus Napoleon and how insects were some of his greatest enemies. And we were like, that would be great. That sounds like a great podcast episode. People are going to love that. And then it was two episodes. And I don't, what are we up to now?
This will be the final episode, and we're at number five on Monday.
Mike just keeps learning more about the history of Napoleon, and he wants to share it, and we keep letting him do it. And we're actually going to hear from, what's the guy's name, Mike, that runs the Age of Napoleon?
Yeah. So in a bit of a coup, you guys have heard it here first because we haven't announced it on the podcast yet. We're going to do a sixth and final wrap-up episode where I'm going to bring on Everett Rummage, who does the Age of Napoleon podcast, and is, you know, more of an expert in the man in the history than myself, and run some of the what ifs of, like, what if yellow fever hadn't decimated the French troops on Saint-Domingue and, like, the French had kept the Louisiana Purchase? What if body lice and typhus hadn't destroyed the Grand Army in Russia in 1812? Like, what would the world look like if not for insect vector diseases, like, destroying his troops in some very specific and important ways?
And it's been fun.
It was initially going to be two episodes, and I couldn't tell the story without the way I wanted to without the background. And so, like, the whole first episode was just like, here's the French Revolution and how Napoleon came to power, because that's important to why he went to Egypt. And so it just grew and grew, and now it's going to be five episodes with a bonus sixth episode for the interview at the end. It's been a lot of fun, but a lot of work. And a really different thing for Arthropod too. We haven't had this long of a scripted run of shows yet. We're usually doing interviews or the three of us chatting back and forth about a topic that we've all prepared on. We did an episode earlier in the year around Valentine's Day on pheromones, where we all boned up on pheromones because I hadn't really thought about them since my undergrad. I thought that episode turned out really well. But diving into these scripted shows that are more like some of the other podcasts that I personally like to listen to has been quite a change for Arthropod. And like that, we're still changing up the format. What, 80 episodes into the show?
Oh, yeah.
However many we're in now.
Always be dynamic.
Okay. My next question is, you guys kind of answer this, but I was going to ask this question, but then Michael kind of answered it. It was, what are kind of the future plans for the Arthropod show? And it's that final wrap up of the Napoleon series, which I'm super excited about because I just love history and being able to incorporate history and science together. Like, that's awesome. And how science influences history is just, it blows my mind every time. It's actually kind of scary because then I have like an existential crisis. I'm like, so the next question really is, if someone wants to start their own podcast, what are some ways for people to get started? So things like equipment or software, hosting services or anything like that, or do you have any recommended sources that people can use to start their own podcast if they wanted to?
What could they find on the internet, Jody? What could they watch?
I think this is great. Okay. So at the ESA 2020 Share Fair, we did a presentation that was recorded. And so I just put the link in the chat. It's an hour-long presentation. Well, I think we were talking, answering questions. This is a little bit of a PowerPoint that Jonathan did. But I think we recommend it. Try it. You'll find out what kind of equipment you need and how to do it. I mean, I think it's pretty... it can be easy and inexpensive. I would say it's time consuming though, when it comes to like all the research that Mike does and all the, like, you know, to get your topics, to schedule with co-hosts if you have co-hosts, interviewees, interviewers, and then editing will take time as well. But I mean, it's a different way to communicate science, and you just actually never know who's listening, and how, like, the your audience, how far and wide it actually goes. So, I mean, I definitely recommend it, and check out that YouTube recording if you want to start your own podcast.
Yeah, that would be the way to do it. I guess if you wanted a short version of it, buy a USB microphone, look into Audible as a recording studio so that you can record your audio and edit it. Get one that's from a couple versions ago. I just heard maybe 2 days ago that the latest version of Audible may have some sort of spyware issues or something with it. So yeah, I know, Mike. So if you can get an older version, that's one way of doing it. There are other versions or other things out there that you can record with, though. The simplest way might be to go with Anchor FM if you wanted to get hooked into Spotify, which is a cool way of connecting with people. It has its own pod catching algorithm, I think, at this point. So if you do Anchor FM, it's owned by them, and it can be all recorded and edited in one package, and then you upload it with them and it's on Spotify. And that's a good way of getting out to a lot of people. Pretty popular platform.
Yeah. I just want to echo what Jody said. It can be as cheap or as expensive as you want, as long as you've got a decent microphone. And that can even be just the microphone on like a USB webcam. That's what I use on my home office. All of our Arthropod recordings are done with my webcam because the microphone is good enough. It can be relatively inexpensive, and there's a lot of free programs that you can find on the internet. You can also dive way in and get expensive audio equipment and expensive editing equipment. You know, that you will see a difference in the quality of the show that you put out. Depending on your budget, that may be important or not. The barriers to entry are not necessarily that high if it's something that you want to try.
Cool. So related to your podcast, someone asked, and I think Jody's actually typing an answer to it right now, but Lerna asked, where can we listen to the Arthropod show, and is it available on Spotify?
Unfortunately, we are not on Spotify at this point because, like I said, they seem to have changed things. We used to be on Spotify. Now we can be found on like every other podcatcher app, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, Apple Podcasts, anything like that. But for some reason, we're not on Spotify. It's something that I need to track down and work on and see if I can get changed. But we're not on there, but you can find us on the web at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. The show is also on Twitter, arthro_pod show. And if you have any of those podcatcher apps, just arthro-pod. There is a podcast out there that's called, what's it called, Jody? Arthropod?
I think it's the Arthro Podcast. I don't know. I've been on it.
Yeah. Yeah. We actually both started like within a month of each other. Me and another guy must have had the same light bulb, like, oh, Arthropod podcast, put it all together. And start a show.
Yeah, I think theirs is the Arthro Podcast, and yours is actually, or ours is Arthro-Pod.
Okay, sweet. So I know we're running out of time, but I did want to ask one more question. I'm sorry that we didn't get to answer all the questions in the chat or the Q&A, but we might, if you guys want to stay for a couple of minutes and answer those after the webinar is done, you're more than welcome to do that. But one more question, and it's related to ESA. So since this is an ESA webinar, I did want to ask something related to the society. So I thought it might be helpful for the three of you guys to kind of share some helpful recommendations on how members can get the most out of ESA as a society, especially for people who might be new to the organization, whether they're students or ECPs or who are probably more established entomologists in the society. Any tips? It doesn't have to be related to science communication, by the way.
Networking. Yeah. Like, that's why in-person is so much better, I guess, for networking.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of it summed up in one word almost, is just like going to the mixers, going to the gatherings, like the tweet up, I've made a lot of connections just going to the tweet up and things like that at
like
ESA.
Sleep like the week before and then go to all the breakfasts, go to like the running thing, go to all the things and then ask questions to anyone that interest, like if you like their, like, the contact stuff at the end of every presentation, write that down, reach out. Like, we do it too.
Yeah. I've been going for over 10 years now. I started going as a master's or as an undergrad student. And the first bunch of years I went, I loved going to talks and learning stuff, but I didn't feel like I got a lot out of the meetings. And I realized later, like the more I went, the more people I recognized when I went, and the networking that you do compounds upon itself. Every year that you go back, you see more people that you recognize and more people that you can talk to. And so the more that you go, the more those networks build and the easier it is to make those connections when you go. And the more people that you know, the better chance there is if there's somebody specific that you want to talk to, and you don't know them, there's a better chance that you know somebody that knows them that can make that introduction for you. It's always a lot easier to have somebody introduce you to like that famous person you want to talk to, or that person you think you might want to collaborate with, than just like cold introducing yourself. And so it's gotten to the point now that I've been going for a decade. I know, you know, everywhere I turn, there's somebody that I recognize or that even if I've just chatted to them a little bit in the past. More of my time is now spent networking even than going to talk sometimes, because I can't get to them. I'm walking to a talk and somebody catches me in the hallway and then I chat with them for 20 minutes. And I've had some really good collaborations come out of that. You know, that have led to publications and career advancement. You know, just go and talk to people or, try to network as best that you can. I know that can be difficult. I hate meeting new people. I'm really bad at it. It helps to, the more connections you make, the easier that becomes because you've made those connections.
I was going to say the same thing. As if you're a fellow introvert like me, and I think Mike as well, to an extent, like programming in some time to go back to your room and kind of reset yourself, making sure you're staying true to that and recognizing when your battery is running out and you're not going to be able to keep going on, is also an important part of the ESA experience, so that you can feel reconstituted and go back in and put on your best face.
Yeah. Or find your extrovert friend and then I'll take you out.
Yeah.
Right. Like you rely on the networks you do have to expand your network.
Someone who is socially awkward, networking can be difficult. And I understand that, but it does work. Networking truly does work. Okay. So, I guess are you guys available to stay for a few more minutes to answer a few more questions?
Yeah. I've got a meeting at 3 that I got to go to, but I can stay on for a little while longer.
Yep, sweet. I can stay. Okay. There's a lot of questions in the Q&A that I've been building up. where to start? So let's see.
Well, I did answer one about, guests and if they're compensated. I want to say that I don't know if Jonathan or Mike are millionaires from the podcast, but we don't make any money. We don't advertise for anyone and we're not compensated at all. And a lot of the stuff we do is like after our work time. So it's not sponsored by our universities or our employers. So it's kind of just like a labor of love.
Yeah. I report our Arthropod listener statistics in my yearly report to my employer. I'm not sure that means anything to them or if they care very much about it, but I put it in there. But yeah, we don't make any money on the show. I spend a little bit of work time on it, but a lot of it is in the evenings or, you know, outside of work hours.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of your work hours and your careers, how do you keep improving your science communication skills as you grow in your career? That's a question that was asked in the Q&A by Laura Kruger.
I read a lot of things. So yeah. I'll read about I don't know. I shut my thing down, but just the always papers about, I don't know. I want to say science communication but it wasn't called that. Sorry, I blanked. Okay. But I'll read because it's the science of science communication, right? Mm-hmm. Because we are not, I am not trained in science communication. It's just something that in this job, you need to communicate. So you just do it. And it's different sometimes because people think like there's outreach, extension, science, communication, and they all kind of overlap in a way, but in some ways they're very different too, depending on what the, I guess, your position or your job and your audience is. So just always learning about your audience, always keeping on top of things. I think it's, for me, it's tiring. I have to keep up with like everything that's going on in the news, everything that's going on locally, anything that's going on with bugs, which is everything, because everything can be connected to insects. Sometimes even like, I don't watch a lot of shows or TV, but I can tell sometimes when there are creepy things going on in shows, and then I get more calls of certain things. Like, I don't know. I can't, you just have to keep up with everything. And so to get better and to keep, like a certain level of connection and performance, you just need to keep going and, you know, learning from other entomologists what's going on in the world. Entomology Today, you know, that's something you keep up with because you need to know if someone's like going to change a name or do this or this is happening or these have emerged. We need to know.
I think part of it's practice too, just getting in and doing it. The more you write, the more you talk, the better at it you get. I can't go back and read some of the earliest things that I've written because they're like looking at them now. It's like, oh, that's really bad. But you know, I had to write those to get better at it and get the practice I needed to be able to write well. Now, podcasting is the same way. Like John said, at first we were all kind of awkward because we were figuring out the medium and figuring out how to interact with each other in a way because we're not in person. And you can even see that a little bit today, like there's long pauses because we don't want to talk over each other. So we're just kind of staring at each other like, okay, who's going to go? And then we all start at the same time. But a lot of it just comes down to practice and doing it so that you can get better at it. And, you know, you're probably not going to be great at it at first. But the more you learn, pay attention to what people like and how they receive it. And if they're not receiving it in a way that you thought they would or you wanted, change what you're doing. Pay attention to the feedback, even if it's not obvious feedback that your audience is giving you, and make changes based on that. But practice.
Practice is important. I would also say pay attention to what you like. Like I sort of said earlier, like if you are going out and listening to certain things or enjoying certain things, figure out what it is about that you like, and incorporate that into your science communication style. It's communication, so it's a two-way street. It's not just what you're saying, it's what you're hearing, what you're reading. And if you can sort of sit and meditate on what it is that you are enjoying about these other things, you can incorporate those into your repertoire as well. It's not stealing, it's growth. We're all learning from each other all the time. So don't feel like you're swiping other people's styles or ideas or anything. You're just figuring out how you're going to present yourself and your science to the world.
Yeah, that's really good advice about how to pretty much just stay on top of your science communication skills. So the next question I have, and I can't remember who was talking about this just now, but we were talking about virtual presentations at some point. And so Maya Holmes asked, does anyone have any suggestions on getting people excited through the switch to virtual presentations? It's been so much harder to get kids excited about bugs through video calls.
Yeah, because they can't touch the tarantula, right? Like they can't see the bug that you're talking about necessarily. I've talked about that with our outreach specialist in our department as well, who's done a few of these things. And what we've been talking about is we're all very used to like giving our talk, right? We go out, we've got our spiel, and then we're going to show them the bugs in between. So if they can't do it in person, he was talking about, he likes to say, okay, now Google the scariest spider that you can think of, like give them something to do to stay active while you are also talking. So it kind of breaks the rhythm up. It's not just you going on and then showing them something. It gives them a task or ask them for input. I know those are kind of relatively simple things. They're not rocket science or anything, but it seems like that changes the rhythm of things and it lets them have input on it and makes it more experiential for them.
Jody?
I did one for some Canadian kindergartners not too long ago, but I had like a camera that came over top and I put the camera in the, was it the roaches? The roach cage, and just like was talking then, and then did like a little poll. Yeah. So like things that they would get to do stuff, and they were just really excited to like probably see somebody new. And, you know, and it was interesting because their questions were, and I let them ask the questions and kind of guide what I was saying instead of me talking at them of what I wanted them to know. I was like, what do you want to know? And like, they wanted to know what my office looked like. So I like unplugged everything and walked around the office and showed them the stuff. And they're just like, wow, it looks like you work really hard. And I was like, that's so nice. And they were just like, they would just like, what's the smallest insect? What's the big, you know, all the other stuff, but which we might have gone into, probably not, but that's what they wanted to know. And, you know, when they leave, they, that they'll remember that other than, you know, this is what we should make, or this is what I want you to know. So, kind of a story that's related to them. And I showed a picture of me when I was a kid looking at bugs. And so, I don't know. I tried. The teacher was like, wow, I wouldn't have known that you're not like a kid person. I was like, I don't know. I just do whatever I think's fun. And maybe I'm just a kid, so I don't know. But yeah, it can get hard over time, but that's why, yeah, small chunks and make it relevant to them. So let them ask a couple questions first. I've even given a classroom, here, ask me so many questions and I'll build a presentation among those. And then I've actually been able to present that one because I know kids that age like really like that. So
I have nothing to add. I don't work with children.
That's fair. Okay, so it's about 2:10, so I guess we'll go ahead and wrap it up. So we're just about out of time for today, but I want to thank Jonathan, Jody, and Michael for joining us today on this webinar and for sharing your stories in entomology and science communication and podcasting, a little bit about your extension experience as well with everyone here today. I hope everyone learned a lot. I know I sure did. I feel a little bit more confident in being a science communicator. I think I'm still a baby communicator, so we're getting there. It's small steps. But if you'd like to chat more with our speakers, I've left their contact information, like their faculty pages and their Twitter accounts, in the chat. So be sure to copy that, because I don't know if the chat's actually saved in the recording. It might be. So it might be in the recording later. So I put that in the chat, and I also left a link to their podcast blog in the chat as well. But I think Jody also posted it. So be sure to follow the ECP Twitter account for more upcoming webinars and any updates from the ECP committee. And I also want to plug that it is voting season for ESA. ESA elections are going on right now. They opened up, I think voting opened up on Monday, and they will close August 18th. So be sure to submit your ballot for the ESA-wide elections, as well as your section-specific elections. I think that's it for me. Thanks everyone for being here today, and I hope you have a great rest of your day. And again, thank you, Jody, Michael, and Jonathan, goodness, for being here today and sharing your experiences. That was really wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
We appreciate the opportunity.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.